back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here today with my very, very, very good friend, Mr. David Pescarella.
You mean this isn't, is it yours?
I wore the wrong hat.
What are we talking about today? I thought this was, is it yours?
What are we talking about today, Mr. Luthor? So, just to give a little background, as we record this, episode 700 is rapidly approaching. And Dave had what I thought was actually the brilliant idea of let's invert it and do 007 for 700 and do a James Bond episode. I really like that idea. But we came up with another idea that we plan on recording. We have not recorded yet, even though but through the time travel magic of podcasting, this episode will air later than that one, assuming we ever record it. If we don't record it, this will become emergency episode 700. So I'm not going to mention what that theory is or what that theme is, because hopefully we get it recorded. But if we don't, then this is coming up as episode 700. So again, Dave came up with the idea of 007, which I just thought that was a great idea, because we every time we come up with an anniversary, it gets harder and harder and harder to come up with what are we going to cover to make it special.
Yeah.
So
this seemed like a no-brainer to me, because I don't have much of a brain to begin with.
Well, that makes you fit in really well with us. So I hope everybody is enjoying the Classic Bins episodes as they air, because I'm actually enjoying them, revisiting them. So hopefully everybody else is as well.
I love what you've done with the artwork on the new ones. I mean, the new old ones.
The classic ones with the old-looking parchment.
I love that. Fantastic idea.
Excuse me. We'll see how many classic episodes we get posted over time. But I think, you know, as long as we keep going, those episodes should keep coming too. I don't know if we'll get 700 of them in classic form.
In about 20 years, what you're listening to will be a classic.
Very true. If whoever is doing the show in 20 years wants to do that, because I'm very confident I'm not doing it that much longer. I would be hard-pressed. I mean, you know, episode 700 or so, I would have been hard-pressed to say that I would be doing it as long as I have when I started doing this. I think it was 2012, which means over 13 years, coming up on 14 years of doing this. I never expected that.
No, how long did you think it would last?
I thought maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, something like that. Somewhere.
And
in
then
that
you
range.
Thought you would have made it big and you'd be on television or something like that.
I did have this fantasy, which I knew it was never reality. Don't get me wrong, that I thought, you know, sometimes you just sit and you think, oh, you know, what would happen if I won the lottery? You know, and you know you're not gonna win the lottery. I thought, what would happen if somehow this became so popular that like Disney came up and said, oh, we'd like you to produce this podcast on a weekly basis and we'll pay you to do it. You know, that was never, ever going to happen. I knew it wasn't going to happen, but it was a cool fantasy to have.
Yeah, that would have been interesting. My wife shuts the light on me.
I thought maybe you forgot to pay the electric bill. So I went old school with my issue that I picked for today. I chose Showcase Comics. Let me actually open up my window here. Showcase Comics number 43 from 1956.
Wow.
And
56?
No, excuse me. It's 1963. 1956, I believe, is the year of when Showcase Comics started.
I know we discussed this, but you know, my mind isn't what it used to be. There's an anniversary issue where they work everybody who showed up in Showcase, you know, into the...
Yes, issue 100, and I do not believe that James Bond appeared in it.
Ah, so it's not complete.
I you know what, I would have to sit and reread it, but I don't believe that. I don't think they would have had the license to do that unless they had, and you know, I'd have to, so like I said, I'd have to sit and reread it, because maybe they had a little cameo in the background somewhere that you know, without naming who it was.
Right. If you had just a guy who kind of looked like him.
Yeah. This is a issue number 43 from March of 1963. And it's an adaptation of Dr. No, which I believe it was, not, I'm trying to remember. I believe it was shortly after the film. It was originally published, according to the notes, as a Classics Illustrated issue, number 158A in the United Kingdom in 1962. I believe the movie was in 61. Might have been 60. I'd have to look, and that would require all sorts of work. So the adaptation is written. It's good. The writing credit is given to Ian Fleming, penciled by Norman Nodell, who I'm not familiar with, and inked by Norman Nodell. The cover is by Bob Brown, and it shows a Bond. It's a kind of a strange, you know, it's a scene from the story, but it's just not what I would anticipate for a cover image. It's got Dr. No down at the bottom corner holding a gun to Bond, who's up on a catwalk pulling a lever. This is another moment, Dr. No, and I'll jam your signals that would have made the American rocket go wild. And Dr. No is saying, but you haven't another moment, Bond. This is your last. It says, based on the novel and now a United Artists film thriller.
It's funny because it looks nothing like the James Bond in the book, the guy on the cover.
Yeah, that's true. So the synopsis, according to the DC Wiki, is John Strangways, the British intelligence station chief in Jamaica, is ambushed, killed, and his body is taken by three assassins known as the Three Blind Mice. In response, MI6 agent James Bond is summoned to the office of his superior, M. Bond is briefed to investigate Strangway's disappearance and to determine whether it is related to his cooperation with the American Central Intelligence Agency on a case involving the disruption of Cape Canaveral rocket launches by radio jamming. Upon his arrival at Kingston Airport, a female photographer tries to take Bond's picture, and he's shadowed from the airport. He's picked up by a chauffeur who Bond determines to be an enemy agent. Bond instructs him to leave the main road, and after a brief fight, Bond starts to interrogate the driver, who then kills himself with a cyanide-embedded cigarette. During his investigation, Bond sees a picture of a boatman named Quarrel with Strangways. Bond locates Quarrel, but finds him to be uncooperative when he interviews him. Bond also recognizes Quarrel to have been the driver of the car that chased him from the airport. Bond follows Quarrel and is about to be beaten by him and a friend when the fight is interrupted by a man from the airport who has been following Bond. He reveals himself to be CIA agent Felix Leiter, and that not only are the two agents on the same mission, but also that Quarrel is helping Leiter. The CIA has traced the mysterious radio jamming of American rockets to the Jamaica vicinity, but aerial photography cannot see the exact location of its origin. Quarrel reveals to have been guiding Strangways around the nearby islands to collect mineral samples. He also tells about the island of Crab Key, owned by the reclusive Dr. No. After finding a receipt in Strangways' house about mysterious rocks naming Professor R.J. Dent, Bond meets with Dent, who says he had assayed the samples for Strangways and determined them to be ordinary rocks. This visit makes Dent wary, and he takes a boat to Crab Key, where Dr. No expresses displeasure at Dent's failure to kill Bond and orders him to try again, this time with a large venomous spider. Bond survives and, after a final attempt on his life, sets a trap for Dent, who he captures, interrogates, and then kills. Having detected radioactive traces in Quarrel's boat where Strangway's mineral samples had been, Bond convinces a reluctant Quarrel to take him to Cab Key. There, Bond meets the beautiful Honey Rider, dressed only in a white bikini, who is collecting shells. At first, she is suspicious of Bond, but soon decides to help him, leading them all inland to an open swamp. After nightfall, they are attacked by the legendary Dragon of Crabkey, which turns out to be a flame-throwing armored tractor. In the resulting gun battle, Quarrel is incinerated by the flamethrower while Bond and Honey are taken prisoner. Bond and Honey are decontaminated and taken to quarters before being drugged. Upon waking, they are escorted to dine with Dr. No. He reveals that he is a member of Spectre, Special Executive for Counterintelligence, Terrorism, Revenge, and Extortion, and plans to disrupt the Project Mercury space launch from Cape Canaveral with his atomic-powered radio beam. After dinner, Honey is taken away and Bond is beaten by the guards. Bond is imprisoned in a holding cell but manages to escape through a vent. Disguised as a worker, Bond finds his way to the control center, a multi-level room full of high-tech instrumentation with an atomic reactor set into the floor, overseen by Dr. No from a command console. Bond overloads the nuclear reactor just as the American rocket is about to take off. Hand-to-hand combat ensues between Bond and Dr. No, with the scientist being pushed into a control board and dying electrocuted. Bond then finds Honey and the two escape in a boat. So, this book has long been on my want list. Really more than any other reason, because it's James Bond. I think it's pretty entertaining overall, but it was a little disappointing to actually sit down and read it, because it, you know, I was surprised to find out that it had been originally a classic comic, but it reads like a classic comic. It doesn't feel like a traditional comic book. It feels almost like the, okay, we live in an era where there is no videotape or CDs or DVDs or streaming services. If you want to see Dr. No, you got to wait until the once a year that it's going to be on TV eventually. Probably hasn't been on TV yet at this point. You know, it'll be re-released in the movie theaters for a couple of times first. So this is your way of kind of reliving it in that era. It feels like the artwork feels very classic comics to me. It doesn't feel so much like storytelling as it almost feels like it's still images inspired from the film.
It's definitely photo referenced. But that's kind of good, I feel.
Yeah, it's and I'm giving you my disappointment with it, but overall, it's still on my want list. I would still like to own a copy of this, and I still think it's pretty cool in its own way, because I really enjoy this movie just the same, and this is a way of reliving it in the comic book form. So, you know, it's definitely a cool adaptation.
I wonder what this goes for. Do you have any idea off the cuff?
Not off the cuff. I'm gonna.
Well,
you give your impression of it.
I had a ball with this.
Go into eBay and see what it goes for.
I enjoyed this. To me, you know what this was like? This was like the version of James Bond you show little children that are too young to see the movie, because he's the ultimate good guy. He doesn't kill anybody in this book on purpose. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You get to the point where in the movie, Dent comes in to kill him. He fires, as they show you in the book, at what looks like the sleeping figure. And the gun is empty. And then, you know, he tries to kill Bond again in the movie. And Bond's words are, "You had your six." And he kills him.
Yeah, it was the ruthless Bond.
In this, it's they fire at the same time. And Bond wounds him. And he's taken into custody.
Okay, I'm going to just interrupt the thought process. I'm looking on eBay, and I'm seeing a 3.5 slabbed copy, $225.
Wow.
A raw copy that looks almost to be a little sun-worn, $165. Another one's a 2.5 raw copy, $135. And I was really surprised to see a a slabbed 9.2 copy of it for $2,640. Now, I don't know if these are selling for that amount. That's how much they're asking for them. And if that's what they go for, I will never own this because I'm not going to spend that kind of money for this.
Unless you get that Disney contract for the podcast.
I'm definitely going in the under $100 range. I'm not sure where in under 100, but somewhere under 100. And if I don't find it in that range, I'm not buying it.
That's going to have to be one of those you go to a flea market and buy a painting, like, and you take the back off and find it there. Like the Declaration of Independence.
If that's going to happen, I'm hoping it's not this issue. I'm hoping it's something more significant than this. I want to find a copy of Action Comics number one, or Superman number one, or Detective 27, Amazing Fantasy 15, something of that ilk.
Even at half the prices of what they're asking, it seems a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, this is probably a very rare book, particularly today.
I would imagine it is. I would imagine there's not a lot of copies of this floating around. So I would be lucky to find it in the price range that I'm talking about. But should I find it, then I'll worry about it then. Do you notice the way everybody's drawn in here? I mean, there's a decent number of black characters in the movie.
That are not black in the book.
And they're not drawn black. They're not necessarily drawn white. They're just kind of... No, actually, Quarrel is drawn white.
or I don't know, maybe he looks kind of Asian. Or maybe Hispanic. It's very hard to tell what Quarrel is supposed to be. And I wonder if it was done that way because of the way the country was at that time.
Well, this would have been, again, this was originally published in the United Kingdom. And I don't know if the coloring changed between then and when it was set for Showcase Comics. But assuming the coloring was the same, this would have been their baby.
This is a literal, they just took it from the UK and published it here.
Well, again, I've never seen the classic comics version of it. So I don't know if it's an exact duplicate. For all I know, there could be changes in the printing process. But I would suspect that it's pretty much reprinted.
Then that is odd. I don't know why they would do that then.
You know, according to the wiki page, it just says originally published in the United Kingdom in 1962 in Classics Illustrated 158A. Hmm. It does not, there's no indication that it was changed. It says the artwork does replicas of the movie stills. So that definitely tells you it's photo referenced. The black characters from the movie appear white in the comic.
Because they nail pretty much everyone, even the minor characters sitting around the table, when it opens playing cards or whatever it is they're doing. Everyone pretty much looks the same. That character looks nothing like what he looks like in the book. I mean, in the movie.
They give you four instances where it's different than the movie. And the first one's the one you mentioned. In the movie, Dent wastes all his bullets firing at the bed before being shot by Bond. In the comic, he tries to shoot Bond with his last bullet and misses. This could possibly be a joke or a correction on an infamous error in this scene of the film in which Bond jokes about Dent's Smith & Wesson had it six, while Dent's gun model actually had seven bullets. The second one is in the movie, Dr. No dies boiled in the cooling pool of the nuclear reactor. In the comic, he is electrocuted after being thrown at the reactor's controlling computer and touching his metal hand in an electric controller. Next one, in the movie, Bond takes the suit of a scientist. In the comic, Bond finds a suit, then fights the scientist. And the last difference they mention is while the comic finishes when Bond's boat is out of gas, the movie follows with Felix finding the agent and Honey and the couple eventually makes love in the boat as the rope connecting their boat to Felix's gets loose. The explosion of Crab Key is also not depicted in the comic.
I'll give you one more they missed.
What's that?
He doesn't sleep with Miss Tara. In the movie, he sleeps with her, and then the cops arrest her.
Right.
In this, she's already dressed. She's on the phone. He takes the phone and calls for the cab, and the police arrive.
See, the problem I have with copying from the stills is you lose, like, kinetic energy in the shots. And I specifically point to the bottom panel on page 9 where Bond is about to punch the driver of the limousine. And you don't get the feeling of any movement in that picture, even though he's got his arm cocked back and ready to throw the punch.
He looks like someone hit him in the back, to be honest.
Yeah. The panels seem to be larger than your comics of that day. Like, you know, instead of having like a 9-panel grid, it's, you know, 5 or 6 on a page. Which actually, in some ways, gives you a greater appreciation for the art when it's done well.
Yeah. I don't have as much a problem. I kind of like the art. But you know what I find interesting? The car Bond is driving in the when he's going up to meet the secretary. In the movie, it's like a mini convertible. I don't remember what it is. And here, it's clearly a big sedan.
Right.
I wonder if they were only given certain numbers of stills and had to work off that.
Well, I mean, at this point, I guess the film had obviously been completed. And you would think that they would be given their choice. So, you know, you'd think they'd be able to pick and choose as they saw fit. But it may not have been. United Artists may have said, here's, you know, 150 stills or whatever from the movie. You know, use them to make the comic.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden I'm drawing a blank. What did they used to call those books when they just took the actual still photos from the movies?
Not photo books, right? It's not
that. There was, I think it's like Fumetti or something like that it was called. I actually have.
Why you use big words?
Make my head hurt.
Hurts now.
I had some of those books when I was a kid. Again, pre-video at home, you know, when you were just limited to the channels you had. I had a couple of Abbott and Costello books. I had a couple of Marx Brothers books with those. And I always enjoyed them. And I didn't have them at one point. I reacquired a couple of them on eBay on the cheap just because they're fun to own.
Well, that was kind of the beauty of, you know, before you could just, when it became a thing that you could record and have your own copy, you know, that was the only way you could live these things.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise you had to wait till they were showing it.
I remember like recording certain things with a tape recorder and just listening to the audio of it.
I did that with numerous television shows.
Yep.
Episodes of different shows that I enjoyed, comedies and dramatic shows. But I found that the comedies worked better in that because the, you know, action or drama shows, you know, you wouldn't be able to, you know, if you couldn't see it, it wasn't as much fun. Although I did do the audio recordings of like each of the Planet of the Apes movies. At the time, I just remember there was like an ad in the books where you would be able to get these 8mm movies. And they had like the Planet of the Apes movies listed, but I think they were like a 5-minute scene and that was it, you know, all you'd be able to get. But it like just made my mind go nuts thinking, oh, I could buy the camera and I could watch the movies in my bedroom, you know, whenever I wanted to. And yeah, that's not really how it worked.
Well, I remember as a kid having gotten It was a toy.
It basically made me want to have DVRs. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I remember I got this gift as a kid, and it was like a hand crank camera that you look through, you know, the eyepiece.
Yes.
And it was Star Wars. And it was segments of the movie. And I remember you could play it backwards if you wanted. It wasn't the whole movie. Maybe it was, like you said, 5 minutes, but it was like, and no sound, of course. But wow, you could watch this over and over again.
I remember going to a Comic-Con and they had like a small little thing on a table where they were showing, it was the scene from Star Wars with, you know, help me, Obi-Wan, you're our only hope. And I remember walking over and saying, wow, you're able to watch the movie. Again, predated VCRs. And the guy was, I just remember he was so obnoxious about, no, we don't have the movie. What are you, stupid? You know, he's kind of like, I was like, well, I don't know. What do you got here? And it was like, again, it was like a 5 minute scene from the movie. But how they even had it in that format, I don't know.
Yeah. But this was a great way of reliving it. I remember having the comic novelization of The Empire Strikes Back. You know, it was like all, whatever, 5-6 issues put together in one. And I beat the hell out of that. I had that before I got to see the movie, I believe.
Now, which one was it, Empire or Return of the Jedi that you just
said? Empire.
Empire. Did that predate VCRs?
I think we got a VCR, and you know, it was probably for us. I don't know when VCRs came out. I think we got one in 80 or 81.
Which is probably about when I got it. When did
Empire, I think, come 80.
Out? I thought it was
80.
I don't know why in my head I was thinking it was 81.
But I don't think it might have been 80. We didn't get a copy of The Empire Strikes Back, you know, for years. Because remember, it used to be like $80,
$90. Oh, no, that's true. Yeah, they didn't make the Star Wars movies available for home viewing for quite a while. That's true. I forgot. You know, I forget. I'm so used to the current day and age where you know, something comes out in the movies and, you know, within a period of weeks, you have it for home viewing.
And then, like I said, when you could rent it, to buy it, it was about $80, $90. And that was a lot of money back then. It's a lot of money today.
I remember I had acquired some sort of bootleg copies of them before they were available for public consumption. I don't know where they were from, and I think, if I remember right, the quality of them was not particularly good.
We got copies in the late 80s. Because my uncle worked at someone at the airport who had two VCRs hooked up to each other. And for $30 a piece, he would make you a copy of, you know, whatever you wanted.
That was good of him.
But yeah, I enjoyed the hell out of this. You know what I always would have liked? And I didn't get it in the novel. You know, I read the novel, too, the original one Ian Fleming wrote. I always wanted a lot more information on Dr. No. And you never got it.
I always found it amusing that he was, you know, supposed to be Asian, and he's played by Joseph Weissman.
Who then was a gangster in Crime Story.
Oh, yeah. So I guess we could rate this one. The cover is, I feel like the cover is atypical. As I said, it's kind of an odd choice to make the cover, but it's always intrigued me, and I guess that's the purpose of the cover. So I'm going to give it a solid B because I've always wanted to own it, and the color cover is one of the reasons. The interior art is good, but it's lacking in that kinetic energy that I look for sometime. You know, so I like the interior art, but again, it's got its weaknesses. So I'm gonna say a B on the interior art as well. It's the actual renderings are fine. The story is credited to Ian Fleming, and it's pretty true to the story as we know it. I wonder how much of a hand Fleming had in this adaptation, if any. But Dr. No, it's an A. And overall, I'll give the book a B+.
I'm going to be a little more generous. I like the cover. It sums up, you know, it has all the key pieces from that final scene. It's not quite accurate, you know, to the story, but it's fun. The only, I really get a kick out of the TV screen with the rocket for some reason. I don't know why, that just draws my attention. The only negative I'm going to give it is I kind of think James Bond here looks like, I don't know, a freaked out Hal Jordan. So for that, it's comes down slightly, but I'm going to give it a solid B+. I even love the font they use on it. It reminds me of something out of the 40s, you know, like Charlie Chan or Fu Manchu or something like that. The interior art, I can see what you mean, but for me, it's so photo-referenced, other than Quarrel, which I'm going to assume, since this is an English thing, that they didn't have a still that had him in it. But everybody else, if you didn't know what it was, you'd go, oh, I know who this is. I know who that is. So I'm going to give it a solid B+. And the story? A. So for an overall grade for me, I'm going to give it an A-. I'm glad you brought this. I never read it, and it was sure a lot of fun. We've gotten to cover Dr. No twice now.
Very true.
Well, I brought a more recent adaption of James Bond, which is still
really an adaptation. It's more of a new tale, isn't it?
It's a new tale.
This isn't anything Ian Fleming wrote.
I just meant more like an adaptation of the character, not the story. This is a more recent one, but it's still, you know, old enough to have its own children by now. This is James Bond, Permission to Die. And this is a cover date of 1989. This was on sale April 25th, 1989, for a whopping. What was yours went for a measly 12 cents. You could buy 20 of those almost with the cost of this book at $3.95. And you don't even get the whole story. This is only part one. This was written and drawn by Mike Grell, lettered by Wayne Truman, colored by Julia Laquement, and edited by Catherine Ironwood. Published by Eclipse Comics and Acme Press. I hope it's not going to explode. Mr. W.E. Coyote. I'm just kidding. We open to a standoff. The police surround an elegant mansion where wealthy partygoers are being held hostage. The terrorists demand the release of their comrades, or they will kill the hostages. The police respond that killing hostages will only result in the terrorists committing suicide. The terrorists respond that they are already dead. The officer in charge confirms under his breath, commentating, as soon as the SAS arrive. When word arrives that the SAS is 5 minutes out, the police fear they will have to go in without them, as they won't have time to get into position. The situation looks very bad, but Scotland Yard has discovered one of the hostages is a man who trains annually with the SAS. Inside, an ambassador asserts that neither his government nor the British will ever submit to the terrorist demands. The terrorists are fine with that. And inform the ambassador that he will join them in death. The ambassador responds that he knew the risks when he took the job. The terrorists then threaten one of the female guests, remarking that she only came along for the party, and it will be one she never forgets. Just as the deadline has been reached, the SAS arrive. However, the terrorist leader knows it's a trap. Just as he orders the hostages killed, a knife hits his throat. As shots begin to ring out, one dark-haired male hostage in a kilt draws an automatic pistol and shoots two of the gunmen. As the SAS crash through the windows, the civilian holds up his pistol. The commander acknowledges him. "Hello, Commander. Nice to see you remember the drill. Still carrying that damn PPK, I see. Six terrorists dead and no hostage casualties. The woman who had been threatened inquires of the heroic guest. I've often wondered what a Scot wears under his kilt, Mr. As he lights his cigarette, he replies, "Bond, James Bond." Their time together is brief, and his thoughts are haunted by images of the past. Dr. No, Jill Masterson, Operation Thunderball, Teresa Bond. As if rescued by fate, he is summoned. A short ride in his DB5 and some brief banter with Miss Moneypenny, and then 007 is before M. After some brief but pointless criticism of Bond's interference with the SAS rescue, M reveals that in response to America's proposed Star Wars, that's the SDI system, the Soviets are developing a response that uses proximity weapons to destroy satellites. And in the event of a tactical nuclear exchange, disrupt communications, intelligence gathering, and missile guidance data. Compounding this situation is the cost of launching satellites, about $500 million, even with the use of the American space shuttle. M reveals that there is a system in development that could deliver an unmanned payload into orbit at a cost per kilo of just over £1. It is the brainchild of the horribly disfigured Dr. Widzedlow, an Eastern European scientist and survivor of the Nazi death camps. Widzedlow is now living in America and refuses to have anything to do with the military establishment. But he is willing to trade his launch system to the British in exchange for the extraction of his niece, Idaina Gala, from behind the Iron Curtain. Bond's mission is to extract her from Hungary and reunite her with her uncle in exchange for the launch plans. Bond will be working with a family member of his late associate, Karim Bey. Bond stops at Q Branch and is notified that once again, his gun is passé, and he's issued an ASP, a modified 9mm Smith & Wesson M39. He has also issued a new piece of luggage with an X-ray shielded compartment. Soon Bond arrives in Budapest, and after settling into his hotel, heads for the casino. There he is given instructions where to meet his contact, Vavra. Bond arrives at the Fisherman's Bastion just in time to help Vavra eliminate an assassin sent to kill him. Vavra has incurred the wrath of their enemies, and a man known as the Wolf, an assassin who kills with a silver jacketed bullet. They'll come in handy in case there's a werewolf. They travel to a gypsy camp where Bond discovers his contact is actually the daughter of Karim Bey. The gypsies will assist Bond in a smuggling operation. As the night progresses, Karim Bey's daughter is slapped by the gypsy chief's son, and Bond becomes involved in a life and death struggle. Bon wins and spares the chief's son, endearing him to the chief. Kareem's daughter, Luldi, doctors Bond's wound and warns him that he made an enemy tonight. Of course, Bond hooks up with his friend's old daughter. Suddenly, the camp is under attack by troops. And although they are defeated, the cost is high. The chief's son has betrayed them and warned the enemy about Bond's target. The chief kills his traitorous son. Just as the party regroups, a shot rings out, and Vavra is dead. While the situation seems hopeless, and Luludi's comments says it is all for nothing. It is over before it's begun. Bond's reply is, nothing is over. Except when I heard that, I didn't hear James Bond. I heard John Rambo saying that.
That's exactly what I heard.
Nothing is over. So what did you think of that?
Well, I love some Mike Rill artwork as a general rule. I don't think he was done any favors in this particular issue by the colorist.
No.
Because I think there's much too much in the way of pastel in this issue. And I think it takes away from the brooding action feel that this title should have. The story itself, the opening of the story, the hostage situation and all feels like it has a kind of a basic, you know, Bond opening feel. Like I could see it being in a cinematic version.
The pre-credit sequence.
Yes, exactly. But I don't know. It's almost like it should be drawn out more. Like the action at the end when Bond rescues them feels like it should have more details to it. It feels like there's not quite enough to give you the feeling of the action that you'd get in the movie. And it's something you always, you know, a risk you always run on these type of stories, I think. If the action sequences, you know, you don't want to overload it with action sequences because that takes away from the storytelling. On the other hand, you don't want to sell it short. You want to choreograph some action so that it feels like you're seeing it in a cinematic way. So I felt like it lost a little bit there, but I do think it was a good, well thought out sequence. I thought, you know, again, it could have been just drawn out, maybe about two or three more pages would have added to it. You know, almost create like a Die Hard thing where he's taking out the terrorists. Once you get past that, you have some of the key moments. You have the Money Penny scene. You have the M scene. You have what I guess is somebody who's supposed to pass for Q somehow, but looks to me like Roger C. Carmel.
yes.
And then you get, you know, then you start getting the Bond in the exotic lands. And that's where it kind of lost me a little bit. And it's often in the movies, it loses me a little bit as far as the narrative, like, okay, he's now going to this location. He's going to this location. And I don't always follow the logic of, okay, why is he going to this place? Why is he going to that place? But in the movies, I can just kind of go along for the ride and just say, you know, at some point it'll make sense. Or if it doesn't make sense, it probably won't matter to the overall enjoyment of the movie. You know, but when I'm reading it, I want a little bit more explanation as to why he's going, where he's going, and what his purpose is, and how he kind of came up with this. I think it's all there, but I don't know if they explain it clearly enough for somebody as dim-witted as me. What did you think of it?
I thought the opening scene was fine. And it, to me, definitely as I was reading it, the way they subtly built it up, that, you know, Bond is there, I think it would translate to film perfectly. And they have all the mannerisms down to ending the pre-credit scene with the Bond, James Bond, to me it's perfect.
Yeah, you could always go for some sort of bombastic music right there.
Right. The One of my less favorite Bond movies is On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And this, I felt, drew a lot from that movie, from the kilt to, I don't even know what that thing is he's wearing around his neck, what it's called. It's not a tie. Do you know?
I'm not sure.
Look up that movie. He's wearing this thing. Then it morphs into that scene of all the flashbacks. And again, that reminds me of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, where he's cleaning, I think he's cleaning out his desk, and he picks up a thing from each one of the prior movies, and you hear a little bit of the theme from each of those movies. I kind of right. got a kick out of that. Through,
you know, I did like that, the way it ties it into his history. It does seem like it's really the all the pre-Roger Moore history, though.
Yeah. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that.
You know, we have the scene from, I'm trying to remember now, there's a scene from On Her Majesty's Secret Service. There's a scene from Thunderball. Mm-hmm. There's a scene from Dr. No and Goldfinger.
Yeah.
No, You Only Live Twice.
I wonder what the reason was to
and not show Commercial with Love.
I wonder what the reason was for not having anything referencing any other Bond.
I don't know. And one of the thoughts I had was, he was probably character modeling him closer to Timothy Dalton than any other Bond.
Yeah. Because they had already made the Timothy Dalton movies, right?
Well, what year was this book?
89. So they
yes. were both out. At this point, I think License to Kill was just out.
So I don't know what that was about. But I didn't have as much a problem with the world hopping, because I'm kind of, we do get a reference to from Russia with Love when he meets up with they show the scene with Karim Bey shooting the guy as he's coming out of the mouth of the poster.
I read somewhere that this is supposed to take place, or it's supposed to build on From Russia with Love, which I found interesting, because when we first talked about doing this episode, Scott was going to be here with us today to do this, and unfortunately he couldn't make it today, but he had a book from Dark Horse, and it was just a small prelude to a story, but clearly it was picking up from Russia with Love in that as well.
Pages 19 and 20, you get the scene right out of From Russia with Love, where Karim Bey shoots the guy with Bond's sniper rifle.
You just need Rosa Klebb to come over with a needle shoe.
To paint in the shin.
So, I mean, I thought this was okay. I didn't think it was bad, but, you know, I'm not trying to say that. But it didn't make me feel like, oh boy, I want to get the next issue.
Right. I think the art, it's not the art, I'm saying it wrong. It's the coloring that's the problem.
It to me, it was a big problem because it took me out of the feel. It's definitely too pastel.
If you recolored this, it would be a large step up.
This is one of the books that I think actually would be better in black and white with a little additional shading.
I could see that. But the pastel does not do it for me.
No, not at all.
And I'm going to be blunt with you. The sleeping with Karim Bey's daughter, kind of, I know that's Bond.
Creepy?
It was creepy. I would kind of expect if I got killed, you wouldn't be trying to hook up with my kid. It's creepy.
No,
I'm sorry.
No, I can honestly tell you, I would be avuncular towards your children.
Just very, very.
I would
creepy.
Not be trying to put the moves on. But you know what? Don't get killed. Let's make it the easy way.
But it is so steeped in the Cold War, which is kind of my wheelhouse. The good old days of the Cold War. You know, I can't stand him. But one of the best funny wise movies I ever saw was Michael Moore's Canadian Bacon. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It's a post-Cold War picture where, you know, the president's trying to get back into the Cold War to help the economy. And he's telling the Russians, like, come on, let's get back in the game.
That's not the one with John Candy and...
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. You know what? I think I may have seen scenes from it.
Rip Torn, Alan Alda's the president. It's just really... It's fine. You know, give the devil his due. It's a funny picture. But yeah, Cold War.
Well, you know, I don't know. I know the technically the Cold War ended, but I don't think it's ever truly done. Because there's always going to be some sort of tensions, and there's always going to be power plays and all of that. You know, I think, and I don't want to get political, but I think, you know, we have this desire to live in a perfect world. And when we can, we're quick to say, see, it's all over. But, you know, I wouldn't think for a second that the world powers would hesitate if things were clearly in their favor to just kind of take over. So I think there's always a little bit of jockeying back and forth that is part of what the Cold War was.
It morphs. That's the thing. It's not over. I mean, look. Everyone, well, I did. I thought after Desert Storm for about 10 minutes that, oh, we're going to usher in world peace now. We're all going to work together. That lasted about, what, 15 minutes?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, part of it, again, I don't want to get too political, but I think there is this
thought process. Well, this is more historic. It's not political.
But I think there's this thought process that we could nation build. We could take an underprivileged country that's under a dictatorship and we can oust the dictator and then have them embrace the American way of life. And that doesn't happen. It doesn't work. You know, you might be able to get rid of the dictator. You might have a faction of that country who is welcoming our influence. But overall, they're going to be looked at as being invaders and they're not going to be welcomed. And the nation building does not work. I think you have to let things somehow go organically. And if somehow then they go towards, you know, the Eastern ways or the Western ways, you know, that's fine. But you can't like force feed people. It just doesn't work. Yeah. And that is Paul Spataro's political moment. And it's not necessarily a negative on either side of the aisle. It's just the world.
Real life with producer Paul Spataro.
Real life is just that, you know, it's sad that you can't have the idealistic peace that we all wish.
We're not going to get to Star Trek is what you're saying. Anytime.
Even Star Trek, you know, it's, I know we're going far afield here. I remember listening to an episode of Star Trek Monthly Monday, and Scott and Chris were talking about how in Star Trek, The Next Generation, they talk about, oh, you know, we've evolved past that and, you know, money is not a factor anymore. And Scott's big thing was, okay, so, or actually I think they both kind of said, so in that world where, you know, people are just doing things because of sense of duty and sense of being a part of things, who's going to volunteer to clean the toilets? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then I think Scott was like saying, and what do you do with the lazy shit? It just, to this day, it still makes me laugh thinking about that. But it's, you know, there is a reality there that, you know, a lot of these things are great in concept, but in practice, they don't really necessarily work.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So I don't think we'll ever get, I don't think we'll see Star Trek in our lifetime.
Oh, we're not going to see it. We'll be lucky we don't see, you know, the post-atomic horror in our lifetime.
Yeah, I think we have a better chance
of seeing the clock ticking either way. We're a lot closer to that.
We have a better chance of seeing Planet of the Apes than we do of Star Trek.
If you see apes on horses with guns, head for the hills. But this was a somewhat fun romp. Okay. But I agree with you. I don't have any great need to find out what happened next.
No, unfortunately, because again, I love Mike Rell's artwork. I always do, and that's why I think this issue would be better in a black and white presentation.
You know, initially I looked at the cover, and I said to my, I wasn't so keen on the way James Bond looks, because you know, you have an image in your mind, Sean Connery, whoever it is. But then I said to myself, if you've read the books and you had never seen what James Bond, you know, looked like on film, that could very well be James Bond right out of the book.
And he does, if I think, you know, it takes a little interpretation, but he does give him the scarring by his right eye that I believe Ian Fleming had in the books.
Yeah. But it's the coloring I don't like. I don't like the coloring on the cover.
No question. The coloring, I think, is the downfall of the artwork. But, you know, when we rate the artwork, which we'll do momentarily, as far as I'm concerned, the coloring is as much a part of it as the inking, which is as much part of it as the penciling. And sometimes even the printing process comes into effect. Although that usually I'm willing to give some leeway on.
The coloring, particularly on the cover, they look like they're orange. And I'll leave it at that.
Yes.
So
that's
shame.
All I have on this one.
Me too.
You want to rate it?
Yeah, let's rate it. The art itself on the cover is great. They're standing in the center of the gun barrel. I think this would make a great cover. The coloring pulls it down to the bottom. There's not a lot else here, but I could spin it that it's a real crappy movie poster. And for that reason, I'm going to give it a C. It's the same with the interior art. It has good bones. It's got good form. For me, the coloring ruins it. I'm going to give it a C+. The story is somewhat interesting. I like the opening credit. I think it held with the way the movies are made. I felt it very creepy, as I already said, sleeping with your friend's kid, particularly when there's, you know, there's got to be a somewhat big age difference there. I just felt that uncomfortable. But it hit a lot of the tropes. It broke back the folks from Russia with love. It's steeped in the Cold War, which I like. There's a wacky scientist, which we kind of need to know more about that we didn't get in this. There's a rescue mission from behind enemy lines. I'm curious if it's going to be the fact that maybe this niece is brainwashed, or if this guy doesn't have. So I guess I am a little curious where it was going to go. But by the same token, I felt the whole attack on the gypsy camp was kind of a rehash of what we saw in From Russia with Love.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost beat for beat.
Yeah.
I'm going to give the story I'm teetering between a C+ and a B. I'm going to go with the C+. This is a C book overall.
All right. So I'm not too far off on your thoughts on this one. The cover, I like your description of it being kind of a bad movie poster. It's okay. It doesn't really grab me all that much, but it's not bad. I just don't feel compelled, like, oh, I need to get this book. So I'm going to say a C. The interior art, I think, I mean, the coloring is really the downfall to the interior art, because when I try to picture it with either better coloring or in black and white, I think it's far superior to what we ultimately got. But you do have to take what you got. So I'm going to say a C on the interior art, which I feel terrible about because I love Mike Rell's art. I think in the right situation, this would be a solid B book, but it's a C. And the story, what I like about the story is it hits the beats that you'd have in a movie. But it does feel a little bit by the numbers, to be honest. And there is the creepy factor in there as well. So I'm going to say, I'm going to go C, and I'm giving it a C overall. It's just, you know, it's just not quite the book that I would have hoped for, especially with when you're looking at Mike Grell as the creator. Before we sign off, I wanted to give a minute to, we got an email from friend of the show, Socrates.
All right.
And Socrates was responding to our recent episode where we talked about our new schedule, and it's, his email is titled Hiatus News. It says, good morning, Bins. Just listened to the latest episode and got the news regarding the hiatus or less frequent episode release. This is much better than pod fading and a great way to share the older episodes that, in my opinion, are semi-evergreen. I'd love to hear some Mike Bailey and Chris Honeywell episodes again. Bins remains one of my favorite podcasts, not just because of the back issue content, but because you guys are awesome to listen to. It's nice to listen to good friends talk about a hobby enjoyed by all, and your banter is hilarious. I'm actually currently happy with my collection. I borrowed Paul's method, and I'm just focused on the errors and runs I like. And I'm finally closing in on completing my Wally West Flash run. I need 4 more issues. Still need to shed some more comics, though. This hobby never ends. Best regards, Socrates. I appreciate the positive thoughts and the compliments. It's always nice to hear that, you know, what you do is being appreciated in some way. So thank you, Socrates. I just, once again, I really do appreciate it. You're a definite friend of the show.
And I want to thank you, Socrates, too. I appreciate you sitting down and taking the time to let us know what you're thinking. It's really great. Thank you. Yeah. I know what you mean about the space, because I'm at the point I would like to downsize, too. But, you know, it's how do you choose what to get rid of?
And it's like choosing between your children.
Right, exactly. And then, because you know what? I did that mistake way back when I
picked between your children?
No, well, back in the 80s, the late 80s, I thought I grew up and I divested of tons of stuff. And then I bought it again.
Yeah.
For much higher prices. So
that's
probably cheaper in the long run to get that storage unit. But thank you again for writing in.
Okay. And so on that note, we're going to call it a night. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show. And we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.